Hello, and welcome to this special episode of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director here at the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the fast attack submarine USS Indianapolis, commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. How are you doing today, Bill?
I'm doing wonderful, Seth. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing fantastic. We're going to get into a little more depth on Fleet Admiral Chester W. Nimitz today. We got some things we want to kind of dive into the man. He was an intriguing character and easily the most influential character in the Pacific War. And seeing as how this podcast is about the Pacific War, we want to talk as much as we can about Admiral Nimitz and little one-offs like this. And this might not be the only one that we do like this, however. But, well, Bill, Nimitz was, you know, we've already done an episode on Nimitz with Admiral James Stavridis, and we got into some of the higher level intricacies of his command and his leadership style. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the man a little bit. What kind of a guy was he? Where did he come from? What were his roots before he got into the role of sink pack? What kind of a guy was Nimitz?
Well, the truth is he had a very hard scrabble life as a youth. His dad died before he was born. So his mom was, trying to raise him. His grandfather was a hotelier who had been a German immigrant who'd actually been in the merchant marine in Germany for a while and kind of gave him the love of the sea. And the hotel that his grandfather built in Fredericksburg, Texas, was built to mimic the look of a cutter bow of a ship. It's kind of an interesting place to visit. And people say, well, Nimitz grew up there in Fredericksburg. Actually, he didn't, because his mother remarried. And when he was a child, less than 10 years old, his mother and his stepfather and he moved to a kind of a bed and breakfast kind of place in Kerrville, Texas. So he moved away from Fredericksburg to Kerrville. And I think that's what he would have thought of as his hometown later in life, was Kerrville, not Fredericksburg. But they're not far from each other. And he was a very ambitious boy and actually wanted to go to West Point, not Annapolis. And when he didn't get accepted to West Point, he worked really, really hard to pass the entrance examination for Annapolis. His grandfather really thought the Navy was better than the Army anyway. And of course, got accepted into Annapolis and did reasonably well at Annapolis. He didn't hit it out of the park, wasn't first in his class or anything like that, but he did reasonably well, graduated as a past midshipman, which is what folks were when they graduated in those days, then was promoted to ensign, transferred into command a gunboat slant destroyer in the early 1906 timeframe, 1907, out of the Philippines, and actually ran his ship aground while in command of that. Of Decatur was the ship.
Inauspicious starts.
No, not at all. He was court-martialed.
Right.
But he recovered. And really, I think that seed was planted in his brain of somebody who went through this terrible event in his career and was given a second chance. And throughout his career, he made a habit of giving people a second chance. And Mark Mitcher is one of the greatest examples of that. Mitcher did not, in the Battle of Midway, did not, provide a glorious, representation of himself and under Spruance. And in fact, was kind of sidelined, put on the bench after the battle. It was both Spruance and Nimitz were pretty sure that Mitcher didn't tell the truth. About
he didn't.
because he didn't, right? And that's pretty serious. I mean, that's fireable offense for a naval officer. And, of course, when I was at the academy, the honor code was front and center in behaviors that's expected of a naval officer. And Mark Mitcher did not exhibit, behavior consistent with the honor code as a captain during the Battle of Midway. And yet, Nimitz put him on the bench, and years later, when he thought it was an appropriate time to take him off the bench as a flag officer and give him a second chance, he did. And I think the Pacific War was better for it. And so that's just one example of something early in his career that had a huge impact on the conduct of the Pacific War when he was a 4-star and later 5-star.
Well, he was a people reader. You know, he was a people person too. And, right. And that, you know, we in our earlier episode about Nimitz, Admiral Stravitas talked about how he had, and you talked about how he had all these personalities to deal with. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say fight with, but to deal with. And there were people that he could read, you know, and it's something that is a great tribute to him, and that he could read people, tell what kind of people they were, tell what kind of leaders they were or weren't in some cases, and inserted them and took them out of situations, you know, at the best time. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Guadalcanal, Admiral Gormley, who was a friend of his,
right,
was God bless him,
senior to him at
right,
one point, right?
Right.
In his career. Now Nimitz is senior to Gormley.
He was, you know, God bless him, he was trying, but he just wasn't getting it done. He wasn't the right guy for
that. He
wasn't
a fighting admiral.
Not at all. Not at all. And he put that one guy who most certainly was, William F. Halsey, in that position. And it, frankly, in my opinion, anyway, and we'll get into Guadalcanal in the near future, but that turned the tide of the war. That appointment, I didn't say Halsey did, but that decision to put Halsey in that command did. You know, it influenced so many other things. But he could read that situation, you know, like a good coach can read his team, you know, like a good football coach can see when things need to be done differently.
He played had that to ability. People's strengths,
yes,
not their weaknesses.
Yes.
And of course, the Marines were already in Guadalcanal when he put Halsey in that position. And the Marines, and these are Marines, not sailors, they just kind of, you know, uproarious cheers, knowing that we finally have somebody in command of this operation who's going to fight the war and not just kind of sit in New Caledonia, which is where Gormley was, and kind of fight it by remote control.
Right.
And that was a great. Now, I've got an article coming out about the dark side of Halsey in World Magazine in September of 2022. But there's no doubt that Halsey brought a lot of spirit to all of the armed forces in the Pacific. Now, remember, Nimitz wasn't just a Pacific Fleet commander.
Right.
In those days, Sink Pack meant Pacific Fleet commander. More appropriately, he was Sink Pacific Ocean Areas, which was the unified commander or the joint commander. So he commanded all Army Air Corps and then Army Air Forces, Marine and Naval forces in the Pacific Ocean areas. And so he was the joint commander. So these matters of understanding people's strengths affected every service, not just the Navy. However, when he was the director of the Bureau of Navigation, which today we call the Bureau of Personnel, he got to learn the personalities of every senior leader who would have an impact on the war.
Right.
And I would say that as much as anything, knowing strengths and weaknesses of all the admirals and senior captains who would fight the war, really paid huge dividends when he was made Sink Pack and Sink POA.
Yeah. I mean, well, he had their dossier, right? I mean, for all intents and purposes. And there's one that sticks out in my brain that he picked out, Nimitz pulled out, a guy named, who's not well known, but Admiral Willis Lee.
Right.
They called him Ching Lee.
Ching Lee.
Yeah. Nimitz pulled him out. You know, Lee was an expert in gunnery. He was an Olympian. You know, he was a gold medalist, for crying out loud, marksmanship. So, I mean, this guy was a shooter, literally. And that's something that the Pacific Fleet needed at that time. Again, we're talking about Guadalcanal. And he put Lee in command of the battleships down there in the South Pacific and said, and I quote, "Now we got a shooter out there." And he was talking about, this is Nimitz talking about Lee. And of course, you know, Admiral Lee takes his two battleships on the Guadalcanal and shoots the ever loving bejesus out of the Japanese, because that's exactly what Nimitz knew he would do.
Right.
And, you know, and that goes back to what you were just saying. He knew who Lee was long before Lee knew who the hell Nimitz was. And he knew he was the right guy for the right job. So he had this uncanny ability.
Yeah, he also created this concept that's very ambiguous and tenuous It was the concept called calculated risk. Mm-hmm. And he gave every one of his fighting admirals guidance that you are to engage in calculated risk. And if you are going to engage a larger, stronger force, which frankly, early in the war, every Japanese task group was larger and stronger,
right,
then you need to assure yourself that you can inflict disproportionate damage on the Japanese fleet. And if you can't, then your duty is to preserve your force. Mm-hmm. In other words, don't go in there and get what little Navy we have left destroyed through overzealousness. And of course, I think he was worried that Halsey was going to be one of those guys who would go in there and duke it out and potentially lose everything in the process. And then we would be screwed because we had nothing left early in the war, in the 42 timeframe.
And that's something too that can't be understated when it comes to Admiral Nimitz is his awareness of the strengths and at that time 41, 42, or let's just say 42, weaknesses of the United States Navy in the Pacific. You know, when people think, oh, Pearl Harbor, you know, we lose the 8 battle wagons. Well, we don't necessarily lose them all, but we, you know, there's significant damage done to the surface force, and all we really have is the carriers and the subs, and that is very true. So, right. I mean, it's, but he knew where to deploy his people or his forces, I should say, at the right time, and how much and how little, or depending on the case, as the case
dial
may
up,
be,
dial down,
yeah. And mm-hmm. he knew he's getting all this pressure from Admiral King to, you know, and this is 42. This is like January, February, to go and hit the Japanese wherever he can, you know, deploy the battleships and all this other stuff, which is ludicrous because mm-hmm. he couldn't.
Too slow, not enough fuel.
Right. And the only thing we had were the carriers, and Nimitz was fully aware of that. Mm-hmm. And he had to be very, you know, very choosy where he put them and when he put them out there and for how long. And he did that. And he left it. Not only did he leave it up to his commanders, but he was the one that made say, okay, yeah, we'll hit this now. And then we'll hit this later. And we'll do this then. But we're not going to do this because we don't have the men or we don't have the ships or the oil or whatever it may be.
And he was aware. I mean, he wrote to his wife, I think it was January. And he said, I'll be lucky if I last 6 months in this job. Mm-hmm. So he knew how tenuous the fleet was and his position was. And then he took that huge chance by betting on some dude named Joe Rocheford and his team and decided to engage the Japanese fleet at the Battle of Midway. And that would, if that did not turn out the way it did, and it's probably a 1 in 20 chance that we would prevail at Midway. We were outgunned, outmanned. They had better tactics. They had better pilots. They had better everything than we did. And, you know, not only would he have gone down if we didn't prevail at Midway, Spruance would have gone down, another mm-hmm. one of our fighting admirals that helped us win the war.
Fletcher.
And we would have lost the what little fleet we had left.
Oh, yeah. But, and I mean, he staked his entire career on that. And, you know, I mean, when you're talking about a naval officer's career in the midst of, you know, the largest war this country's ever fought, it's a small, minuscule thing. But what I think people need to understand is it was his career, but it was the flow of the war. It was the course of the war at that point, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, get into Midway and we talk about, you know, what all the, you know, the intricacies and if it's the turning point and all this other jazz. But at that time, this was the biggest thing. And you hit the nail on the head, you know, earlier when you said that he trusted his subordinates. He believed in intelligence. And you said that the Japanese had better everything than we did. The one thing they did not have better than we did was intelligence. We had that naval intelligence, the cryptanalyst at Station Hypo, that and Joe Rocheford that were able to break that code and inform Nimitz. And Nimitz had the stones to believe what Rocheford and his people had been reading and presented to him, and he bet the house on it and he won.
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the things that occurs to me, because, you know, Seth, I've mentioned this to you before, but I occupied the very same office. And when I say office, I mean room that Admiral Kimmel did and Admiral Nimitz did early in the war. So Kimmel mm-hmm. during the Pearl Harbor attack and Nimitz until August of 42, was operating out of my office when I was Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor. And so, you know, I've thought about him for decades. And, you know, since the academy, since I was a plebe, because my textbook was co-written by Admiral Nimitz and my professor, E.B. Potter. But the point, what really grips me is you see this man, white-haired, he is missing half his teeth because of the dental practices of the day. If you had any problems, they would pull your teeth. He had gold tooth up front, which is why you never see a photo of him smiling. In fact, he's on a cover photo of Life magazine, and there's a little tiny glint of that gold tooth you could see. And he was very upset. I have a copy of that magazine. He was very upset about the fact you could kind of see a little hint of that gold tooth. But he looked old, right?
Right.
He was 10 years younger than I am today when he took command of the fleet. And it's like, now he was an exercise fanatic, as was Bruins. Yeah. He would walk miles in the morning before breakfast. And you know, so they had that in their favor. And of course, medicine wasn't what it is today. So, you know, there's no excuse. I have no excuse for not being in better shape 10 years in my 60s than he was in his 50s. But really, he commanded the greatest fleet the world has ever known. Mm-hmm. And he did it with magnificence, effectiveness, and aplomb. And, you know, I don't think the Navy will ever see an admiral like Nimitz again. Now, I hope I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. But I wonder today, and I don't know many, I've been retired from the Navy for 15 years and long enough that I'm not sure I know many of the active duty admirals that are still in the Navy today. But I hope that the country has produced fighting admirals, the likes of which we saw in World War II, in the Pacific War, because, you know, if the world seems to be, heat seems to be brewing in the Pacific today, and God help us if we don't have another Nimitz, another Halsey, another Spruance. I should have said those two in the opposite order. Another Spruance, another Halsey, and all these other great admirals that performed so magnificently in that war.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, but it all starts at the top, you know. And he was the right man in the right place at the right time. And you got to give credit to old FDR too, because he knew it. You know, he handpicked Nimitz and said,
well, get there's his ass a huge out there. Difference, though. FDR made it his business to know the strengths and weaknesses of his senior military officers. Do we have any confidence that any president in the last 40 years has done that, right? So when he went to Frank Knox, who was Secretary of the Navy, and he said, tell Nimitz to get the hell out to Pearl and stay there until the war is won.
Right.
He wasn't wondering, tell me about all these admirals and who we should send out to Pacific. He knew them well enough to know who the right guy was to send out to Pearl Harbor. And, you know, same thing with his generals. When Marshall might have been the right guy to go to Europe and commanded that, but he knew, General Marshall, I need you here.
Right.
And that guy Eisenhower, he's pretty good, isn't he? That's the guy who we should put in charge out there. And again, the right guy. And if it had been another president, it had been Wilson.
Right.
Things could maybe the first Roosevelt, maybe Teddy Roosevelt knew his military commanders well, too. But if it had been Wilson or any of the presidents between Roosevelt and Roosevelt.
Right.
You know, God knows how this war would have gone.
Well, it's something, too, that a lot of people probably don't know is that he actually tried to get Nimitz in command of the Pacific Fleet before.
Earlier.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he'd offered it to him, and Nimitz turned it down. He didn't order him.
There were 50 admirals who were more senior than him, and one of them should get it before he did. Yeah, so that's right.
He could have been, you know, he could have been in that position of husband Kimmel very easily.
On December 7th.
On December 7th, yeah.
Exactly, and then he would have been the guy fired.
Right.
Or maybe not. But anyway, maybe he wouldn't fall into the trap that Kimmel fell into. And then we're getting back into our episode on Pearl Harbor, where we debated whether it was right or wrong to fire Kimmel.
Right.
And the same logic would apply to Nimitz if he had been the Pacific Fleet commander on December 7th, but he wasn't.
Right.
And the country is better off for the fact that he was the guy that was sent out there at the end of December.
The country's better off for it. The Navy's better off for it. And frankly, probably so are the Japanese. You know, that might raise a few eyebrows when I just said that, but it's probably the truth. Because, you know, and as the show, as our program continues to develop as we go through the years of the war, you know, we'll talk about some of those islands that we hit, you know, Peleliu and Guadalcanal, Tarawa, and, you know, and on and on and on and on and on. And we'll talk about some of the islands that we didn't hit. And the reason for that, of course, is because of the strategy that Chester W. Nimitz basically, you know, came up with, which, of course, is the island hopping Central Pacific Drive. And that's, you know, it saved a lot of lives. It cost a lot of lives, for sure, on both sides. But it also saved a lot of lives.
It did. It did, because it aided the defeat of Japan in the most economically
timely manner
possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, our episode on Nimitz that we did with Admiral Stavridis was wonderful. As a retired four-star, he could provide a perspective that neither of us could. No. And so it was wonderful. But every conversation we have in the unauthorized history of the Pacific War is going to revolve around this dude who ran the Pacific War, and that's just Chester Nimitz.
Exactly.
And so it was right that we had a second episode on him. There's just so much to unpack on this, perhaps the best admiral the United States has ever known.
Oh,
and it was good that we covered this.
Undoubtedly. And, you know, I've been often described as I'm a historian, but I've also often been described as a battle head. Like, I just talk about the planes and the guns and the shooting and all that good stuff. And we're going to get into that a lot on this program, but it's imperative that we talked about the leadership that affects everything that happened before and after. And that was, of course, Douglas MacArthur and Admiral Chester W. Nimitz, because those are the two big ones in the entire war. Mm-hmm. And it's imperative that people understand both who these people were, how they made their decisions, and why they made their decisions, because they, as you said, they literally affect every single thing that happens from the time of December 7th until Tokyo Bay in 45.
And we probably said this during the MacArthur episode, but they affected their decisions exactly the opposite, where Nimitz put the war first and MacArthur put himself first.
Right.
And that affected everything that would transpire from 1941 through victory in September of 45.
Yep. Absolutely. Without a doubt. It's very important. He's the central, Nimitz being the central figure in the Pacific War, in my opinion. And I know, I don't think you'll disagree with me on that one.
No.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. We want to thank you guys for listening to this special little one-off on Admiral Chester W. Nimitz. And as always, please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcasts. Give us a rating and review. We would certainly appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this very episode and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion, which we always welcome, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And once again, want to thank you guys very much for listening to us. My name is Seth Paradin. Bill.
And I'm Bill Toady. See you next week.